Hi, everybody. It's Kim West, and today I am here with Allison Schaefer, author of three amazing books, but the one we're going to talk about today is called Breaking the Good Mom Myth, Every Modern Mom's Guide to Getting Past Perfection, Regain Sanity, and Raising Great Kids. Thank you so much, Allison, for coming and talking to us about this amazing book.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure. We need to get this word out to more moms.
Absolutely. I was just thinking about when I had my first child 17 years ago, and you know, her being, you know, maybe a month or so old, and, you know, not a horrible delivery compared to a lot, but, you know, I was having a hard time breastfeeding. She cried a lot, and, you know, I was sore from delivery, and I thought, you know, where's the sisterhood? How come my other friends and other women didn't tell me that this could be so hard, that it wasn't this sort of piece of cake, that you all of a sudden know how to do everything and be the perfect mom? And I just wished that this book was around then and that I could have read this. I think it would have helped me feel better.
Well, I joke that this is my autobiography because this book came from my own personal experiences and the lessons that I had to learn myself. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just sort of taking forward the message, although my training is in psychotherapy, so I've got some good psychological information to share. Mm-hmm. I, too, at that time was just a mom, and we're same age. My mm-hmm. eldest is 17, mm-hmm. and when I was home alone with her for the first time, I was living in an apartment building in a part of town where everybody had nannies, all the rest of the working women were away. I was not accepted into their groups. I was socially isolated. And same thing, I thought they were going to put like a little banner across my chest and say, welcome, and drop off fruit baskets. And I thought, welcome to motherhood. It was the most disappointing thing ever. It's no wonder so many people suffer postpartum depression. We pump them up with all these ideals, and they're just, they're really false, and they're, I think, really, quite frankly, harmful. So this book is supposed to be a bit of an antidote to that.
Thank you. Yeah, and you can see for all of you, because the cover is posted on the membership site, the fabulous picture with like June Cleaver cover on the top with looking at her children, and she's perfectly dressed in her heels. Yeah, yeah. My mom said she came home in a skirt and heels from the hospital. God. So today we could just talk about this for hours, and I'm sure all the other parents can relate. So in this fabulous book, you talk about eight myths, which I have again posted a listing of those myths in the membership site. And I thought maybe we could try to talk about even briefly all of them, although, geez, I think we could talk about hours on each one.
Per what? I completely agree. Let me tell you, Kim, I came up with those eight myths because when I was working with parents over the phone, I have a coaching practice, there was the same correction in their thinking that I had to do with pretty much every caller. And so what I realized, they're seeing this framed wrong, and rather than me telling one person at a time, why don't I write a book that explains, hey, you know what, most of society has this mistaken idea or this mythological idea of what we need to do to be good in our parenting, and actually, from a psychological perspective, it's not getting us where we really think we want to go. And that's where those myths came from.
Uh-huh. That makes complete sense. Let me quickly list them off, and then we'll kind of dive in quickly to each one. So the myth of self-care is selfish. My children are a reflection of me, my personal favorite. My marriage can wait. Good mothers are all caring and all protecting. Good mothers are in control. Good mothers manage sibling conflict. Only the best education for my child. And good mothers make life fun and entertaining. I hope you're all smiling at these and picking the ones that you can relate to the most. So let's talk about self-care is selfish. I loved some of the points you outline here in the book on why self-care is important. I didn't know if you wanted to say
We're caregivers. I think we forget that you would not expect a nurse or an emergency room doctor to work 24/7 giving care to others without going home and sleeping and relaxing. They're going to end up making mistakes on the job, and that's what happens to us. We think, oh, I must put the kids first. This childhood is short. I can wait. I'm the grown-up. and we get run down and our wit gets short and we really aren't modeling to our kids self-respecting behavior. We're not modeling balance. And so what I find is now that a lot of moms are saying, oh, you know, I get it. We're supposed to be, you know, going to yoga and we're supposed to be getting manicures and looking after ourselves. And what they do is they just add more pressure to themselves because they don't want to go to yoga. So I tell people you have to look after yourself, but what your formula is completely different than what the rest of society chooses for themselves. And so stop reading those magazines that tell you you got to be at Pilates at 7 o'clock in the morning or you're not a good, you know, yummy mummy. That's it's terrible that we've
yeah.
added this whole other layer of things on our to-do
yeah.
list.
Like you have to
right?
be
now
you have to be sexy, a sexy mom too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, have your omega-3 flax oils and, you know, like suddenly there's like trends. There's trends in self-care
yeah.
that are actually, frankly, they market it as self-care, but it really, for many moms, is just a burden. So I'm asking moms to say, listen, take time for yourself. Do it as a small experiment because it's amazing how resistive, you know, you would think they'd want to take time for themselves to go to a movie.
Yeah.
And they squirm out of it. And then I say, how about just one little experiment? Could you just try maybe if you like reading, why don't you just like take an hour, you know, go down to the coffee shop, have dad look after the kids, get a neighbor to look after the kids,
yeah.
go read at Starbucks for an hour. And after they take me up on the challenge of an experiment, they say, you know what? I was a better parent the whole rest of the night because I was
yeah.
rejuvenated. So, but I really,
that.
It's amazing how much resistance you get to people taking
time. Oh,
I
can relate to that. I've seen myself do that too. Like, oh, mm-hmm. no, I don't have time. I'm going to feel guilty if I do it. And what's the point? Exactly. Yeah.
Until the kids start saying, Mom, do you think you need to go, go to the coffee shop and read a book? You're really hard to be around right now.
Yeah. Really, we want you to go away for Girls Weekend, they told me.
Yeah. And so here, my formula, again, different than other people's, I was very sustained by knowing that maybe every 6 weeks or 2 months that I would get together with my girlfriends and we would go away overnight somewhere. Mm-hmm. And just having the dangling carrot of knowing that I had that next appointment with my friends on my calendar was incredibly sustaining. If I didn't have the next one on, I'd start to get antsy right away. But that
yeah.
was me. Some people don't like to go away overnight. Some people would rather do a weekly book club or just go to
yeah.
a movie on their own, go to a matinee in the middle of the afternoon while their kid's at drop-off center or something. So I can't say what it is for people, but I'm just saying find out what it is for you and do it.
Yeah.
It's actually helpful to your kids.
Yeah, and not going by what others think. So
exactly.
can you
yeah.
quickly say something about, because I know we could talk about this, the self-care is selfish for a long time, but this was very interesting and different to me when you wrote here that selflessness is really about superiority.
Well, this is the psychological backdrop to what happens with a martyr, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is when you say, oh, no, I couldn't possibly, you know, everybody before me, like, oh, woe is me, I will be the selfless person. There's this mistaken idea we hold in our heads that people who are selfless are somehow better than other people, and that really what they're doing is they're elevating themselves above others and trying to improve their sort of social status. And so the motivation of saying, oh, I'm going to put myself behind everybody else is, in a sense, really very self-interested. You're really saying, I'm putting myself up above you. Look at how superior I am that I would never take or ask anything from this family. So they feel like if they did look after themselves, they would have to give up their superior position of being a martyr. And so once you kind of point out how the little psychological game works, because we don't know these things. It's in our preconscious mind. We don't know we're doing this. You kind of go, yeah, heck, that doesn't sound like the kind of thinking I want to have, you know? And so once you reveal it to them, most people go, yeah, that is a little bit superior, isn't it? You know?
Yeah, I like
that.
Not that it was,
you know, I don't want people to think I'm blaming or saying poor intention. It's just because I have psychological training. This is the way the human brain likes to work. And so it's nobody's fault. It's just it's a common default thing.
Often our mind is not our best friend.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
We need, and,
that's
you know, what's the old expression there? You know, you need we need to have an examined life, right? So I present all of this in a way to be helpful, useful, and to allow people to grow a little bit more as a person. It's not meant to be wagging the finger. And I think the tone of the book comes across as disarming and embracing, you know?
And I love the sense of humor. Absolutely. I felt like, I could relate to that, and it didn't make me feel bad. No, I love the way you wrote this book.
If we're not laughing at ourselves, you know, there's the first cornerstone to mental health, man. We got to be laughing at ourselves. Yep. We got to be laughing every day, you know.
Right.
And we're not going to make improvements on our family lives and on ourselves if we don't laugh through it.
Absolutely. I agree. That's even a small step in self-care.
Totally. Absolutely.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how about this myth, my favorite, my children are a reflection of me. You know, as a family therapist myself, like you, I definitely can relate to this one.
Don't you worry about that, where you're like, well, you know, you're supposed to be the expert. What are your kids like? Like, are we supposed to have poster children, Kim? Like, I was so afraid of my career actually being a burden on my children that at one point they finally said, you know, Mom, other moms talk about their children. Like, you never talk about us. And I was trying to protect them because I didn't want them to have to carry the burden of my, you know, public
and
career.
And even good mothers who are therapists make mistakes.
Oh, do we ever? I tell them that. I say, I wouldn't want to burden you with being a perfect mom. How would you ever go into motherhood? That would be a terrible thing to do to you. The more I make mistakes, the more I show you that we're just humble humans. So I think I was trying to protect them, I think, more than I was trying to protect myself. But I was, very clear that I can shape and influence and do my best. But there really is, if we were to really think that our kids were truly a reflection of us, think about what you would have to believe, Kim. You'd have to believe that human beings are just simply lumps of clay that you have the power to mold in the image that you want. And how sad is that, to think that there's no creative influence of the individual to decide for themselves to be authentic in the way that they need to be authentic? You know, we can't have all that power. Who I wouldn't want to have all that power.
Yeah.
You know, so we can do good parenting, but you know what? Kids are ultimately get to add their own creativity to what they're going to make of our parenting and what they're going to make of themselves. And we really have to understand that when we're at the edge of our influence and let the rest go.
Yeah, I love that.
Some kids
that
are going to have a short tantrum.
Yeah, that they come into this world with their own little agendas and temperaments, and we can help shape it, but you're right, we're not in control of it.
I tell people, it's a little bit like, flowers growing in a meadow, you know, wildflowers in a meadow. Some of those we call weeds, but that's actually a human label. And to the natural system of things, there's no weeds. There's just different species, and they all do different things, and they all look different ways. And so that's what we get. Our kids are just, you know, the flowers of life. And so you might have the short-tempered kid who, when they don't get their way, would like to melt down, on the floor. And that might be an embarrassment for you, but you could parent and follow everything that technically would be the best enhancer for the, you know, best way to respond to a tantrum. And your child might decide, that's fine, I'm still going to tantrum anyways. It doesn't mean you failed at what you've done. It doesn't mean you're not attentive or not, responding in the way that is correct. But you have to let that go.
Yeah. And I love how you talk about, you know, the perfect mother. Sounds so good, though, is one of the subtitles in this chapter. And what a trap that is. Yeah.
Well, everybody cobbles together an idea of what a perfect mom is, right? But that's the problem. We cobble it. So we say, well, Sally manages to get her kids to kindergarten and still bakes in the morning. And, you know, Angelica over here, she has these wonderful kids, and she still has this cottage up north and maintains two properties and seems to get her grass cut. And so then we roll it all into one person as if all those qualities could exist in the same space and time. Well, the truth is they're making choices, and there's things that they're good at, and there's things that they're not good at, and there's things that they do, and there's things that they don't have time to do that they've passed. And we somehow just take the best qualities of all these different people in our lives and magazines and Hollywood movies, and we make some iconic, if it was all perfect, it would look like this. And it's false. It doesn't. There is no perfect. And I think it's actually a sick pursuit, to tell you the truth.
I think
looking for improvement and contentment is a much better goal than perfection.
I love that. Improvement and contentment. Yes, well said.
Perfect, perfect just leads to nothing but psychological problems. Let
yeah,
me tell you
and
that.
Feelings of failure.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. You're not perfect, you're a failure. Boy, that's a large margin of error. It's very discouraging. It's a lot of wasted energy worrying about how we're doing instead of actually getting on with doing life.
I love the saying, I must not be a perfectionist because I'm not perfect yet.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good one like this, yeah. And then another wonderful myth, my marriage can wait.
Oh, boy. You know, we know, I'm sure the stats in the U.S. are about the same in Canada, you know, that we've got 50% of marriages that are ending in divorce now. And a lot of people have this idea that childhood is short, that a child comes to the family and they're somehow exalted and held up. And I think of that in the movie The Lion King. You know, here's our little cub, here's our little baby, and we shall all lie down on the ground and bow to this new baby's presence. And it becomes the center of the universe, which is really interesting because in the old days, a baby joined the family. And that's actually really important that they join a group. But instead, we exalt them and hold them up. And we let the other members of the family take a second seat. And it's often our spouses who take the hit, kind of like, you know what? You know, we gave vows saying, you know, till death do us part. You know, we had a young baby. I'll deal with you later. You'll wait. Mm-hmm. And more we find that in that waiting period, you're not sustaining a relationship. It's like a shark. If it doesn't move, it dies. You have to put living energy and love into a relationship every day to sustain it and keep it healthy. You know, love is a verb. You don't get to say, I'm just going to park you in this parking lot and circle back at 7, you know, when the kids are in school.
Yeah.
And so it's actually harmful to the kids when they don't get to see what it's like to be in a loving, vibrant relationship. They learn about human relationships by watching mom and dad. So if anything, I think you should be the other way. You should say, we need to really show what love is all about to our kids. And we should show what, you know, great respect and paying time and paying attention and, you know, valuing someone enough that you choose them over work and do all that great. Display that to your children. How beautiful is that?
Yeah, that is so that they can go out and experience that in their own adult lives.
Because we see that kids will replicate what they've experienced because it becomes what they just think is the norm,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So you create your own life according to what your norm was when you were growing up.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of kids, you know, don't see their dads until after they've gone to bed. They don't ever see mom and dad together because they put their kids in so many extracurricular programs. You know, we end up doing the whole, you take Janie to ballet, I'll take Bob to hockey. Then we'll, you know, and we don't really see our parents together. You know, children don't see their parents together.
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, it can be being creative. You know, you like, for example, why not have a little quickie at lunch? You know, I'm too tired at night. Well, the kids are always around. Well, fine. You know what? For $100, go get a hotel room. These are solvable problems if you decide that you want to make it important enough. Start your date nights. And Kim, again, this is like I said, it's a self-confession, this book. I didn't take a date night with my own husband until we started taking a parenting class. And so we had to get a babysitter. And then after the parenting class, we would go out and talk about the class and have a glass of wine. And after the class was over, after 8 weeks, I said, this is the highlight of my week. I think we need to just stop going to the class is done, but let's keep having the glass of wine and going out, you know?
Exactly, and connecting.
Connect.
That's great. We all kind of, there's so much that I loved in this chapter also that I have starred and underlined. And I loved this little box here on page 73, common phrases heard from children raised in families with healthy marriages. Yuck, take it somewhere else, you two lovebirds. So you're showing affection. Love that. Will you show me what you and mommy are learning at your salsa classes? So you're showing that you have interests together besides parenting. Grandma says she can't wait to spoil us all weekend long while you guys are off on your weekend away. So you're showing them that you take time away for just the two of you to be a couple. And I love this one, too. Wow, I thought Mom was going to be so scared to tell Dad about denting the car, but she wasn't. Maybe I can tell him about losing my expensive baseball glove, after all. And then you're modeling to your children how to handle life's problems and conflicts. So that was a great list.
And again, it's sort of a reminder to parents that I understand that you are putting your kids' best interest at heart, But maybe you haven't seen it through the idea that when you go away, you're not being a bad parent because you're not there loving them and kissing them and attending to them. You're actually being a great parent because you're saying, gosh, I can't wait. I'm going to visit with Grandma. I could use some spoiling. And, wow, look at you two being in this loving relationship. So you are doing the best for your kids. I'm really trying to drive that home that this is helpful to children.
Yeah, yeah.
When we help ourselves, when we help our marriage, we're helping our children. Because sometimes that's the only way to convince parents.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Thank you for all of that. And then the next myth is good mothers are all caring and all protecting.
Aren't we though? This really is interesting because as much as we have seen improvements with, you know, the women's rights movements and, you know, feminist issues have moved us culturally. Mm-hmm. I would still say that when you look at the hard wiring, there still are some gender differences that seem to run as main themes through people's lives. And you will still see that a man still feels that he needs to provide and protect for his family. Like if you want a man to go into a serious depression, have him be unemployed. You know, that is just that just cuts them so short. And for women, if we're the nurturers and the caretakers and the make sure everything's kind of socially going on well in our family lives, and when we think that we're not doing that, we feel like this is like the biggest kind of failure. So to be a woman, to be a mother, is to be caring and protecting. It's a very deep need that we have, and yet it can go too far and trip us up and get us the things that we don't want to achieve.
Mm-hmm. And some of these give a nice list of telltale signs of a pampering mom. Do you
now
routinely?
Sorry, I was just saying. So this is the example of yes, it's good to be caring, and yes, it's good to be protecting, and yes, that's part of the job description. But when we get busy being over ambitious or overdoing. Mm-hmm. That's when we call it pampering, when we start to do for our children things they can do for themselves, or actually, you're going to read the list, so all else I want.
Oh, okay, yeah.
It describes it there, but that's the overdoing.
Yeah, it says, do you continually do things for your children that they are capable of doing for themselves? Do you take over your child's responsibilities, cater to and provide special services or special treatments for your child? Do you go about arranging life so your little one is protected from having to experience life's routines, knocks, and blows?
So this is an example of this would be your child doesn't get invited to a birthday party and you're so devastated about it that you throw them a birthday party even though it's not their birthday. You know?
Yeah.
This is calling the school to say his best friend got put in the other classroom. Can you move my child there? You know, I want him to be with his friend instead of in a new class with a teacher he doesn't know.
Yeah.
You know, those are the hard knocks of life. They're not fatal knocks. It's just they're kind of disappointments. They're just challenges that we have to face socially. And when we start to correct and smooth out the ruffles of life, we're actually protecting our child from developing what we call a psychological muscle. You know, the robustness to say, you know what? Oh, I can manage when life knocks me down. I pick myself up and I get on with it. And really, that's where true self-esteem kind of comes from. You know, we're making them fragile when we do this kind of over-ambitious caregiving.
I've talked to parents about how it's not logical, but the child ends up feeling more insecure when a parent overdoes because it's like, well, obviously the parent must not feel incapable. So I must not be.
Exactly. Because that is the subtext of the message, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know,
exactly.
I don't trust you well enough that you will do it on your own, and therefore I will do it for you. What a vote of non-confidence to give your child, you know?
And
other kids, sorry?
I was going to say there's even some research showing now that the college counseling centers are filled within the slots for counseling are filled within the first 2 months. There's like they've seen a huge up swing of this in colleges because the kids are anxious because they're less capable of sort of managing on their own and figuring because they've had someone else do it for them.
And they're dropping out not because they can't handle the academics. They're dropping out because they don't know how to live away from home. They don't know how to make a meal. They don't know how to call the superintendent to say, I need a light bulb changed in the hall. They're failing at the life skills. And you're right. Think of how scary it would be to be out in full adulthood and really have the mindset of like a toddler who's saying, who's going to feed me? Who's going to change my diaper? I don't, you know, I need a primary caregiver to be around me and to be stranded. And so we're not preparing them for life when we care for them this way. And really the parents need to know that pampering is as psychologically damaging as neglect. So it's a serious thing. And the spike in anxiety in our youth today really speaks to that we're paying the price for this shift in our parenting style now.
Yeah, I think it's so finding that balance that, of course, once again in life, that you're there for them, to come to them, to, you know, support them and encourage them, but you're not going to fix it and do it for them.
Exactly.
That's
exactly.
Right.
And being able
easier
to find that place.
Easier said than done sometimes.
Oh, and we will misstep. This is a perfect place to know that we're going to make some errors. But I just love that Stephen Covey analogy where he talks about the airplane leaving New York and flying to L.A. And if you look at its flight path, you know, 80% of the time it's not on its perfect trajectory. But in the end, it gets there. You know, so, you know, if we keep the long-term parenting goal in mind and we all stumble through doing our best on a day-to-day basis, you know, we'll get there. If you stop and ask me, did I handle this situation right now today perfectly? No, but am I on the right trajectory? We have to be gentle with ourselves. Chances are we'll get there.
Yeah, that's great. Great. Nice metaphor. Mm-hmm. Parents who are listening, not that we're going to go through this, but one of the nice things about this book and this chapter is she gives, Allison gives some responsibilities that children could have from age 2 all the way up to age 10, I believe, or 9, which is wonderful.
Well, because, you know, that's true, right? If you go to the doctor's office, they'll give you the milestones for when they're supposed to, like, say 2 words or roll over on their belly. But, you know, when can you ask them to load the dishwasher? Like, let's get to some serious developmental milestones here.
was great. I loved it. You don't see that a lot, so thank you.
No, so here's at least a little bit to get parents. They'll either read this list, Kim, and say, oh, I'm doing pretty good, or they're going to say, wow, I got a 9-year-old that is doing what 2-year-olds do. I really better get on it.
Step it up, yeah. And then how about this myth? Boy, we could say a lot about this. Good mothers are in control. Because we do like our control.
Well, yes, and a lot of times people were very impressed with becoming a mother because as a child you looked up and you said, boy, who's running the household? Well, it's, you know, mom, and when I grow up, I'm going to have my kids, and this is how I'm going to manage the household. And boy, you know, I spent a lot of time putting myself through law school to go into the workplace, and I, you know, have great corporate success because I can manage and control my spreadsheets at work, so I'm going to employ the same tactics that make me successful professionally, I'm going to try to apply to my personal life. And, you know, control actually sabotages human relationships. It's not the best strategy, sadly, and it really backfires on us.
Mm-hmm. So how can you say a little bit more about how do we as moms find ourselves there, or maybe better yet, if we don't think we're there but we are, and some steps to get out of it or ways to see it? Or it's such a big topic.
It is a big topic. I'll tell you, actually, I'd say probably 90% of the individual work that I do is around issues of control, whether it's, you know, a lot of using control as our methodology as a mom often is modeled then to our kids, who then want to use control. And what we do is we get into power struggles, and we lock horns with our kids who have the same power style as us. And so we have a lot more conflict and a lot more fighting. So this is really about learning to recognize in yourself when you get into these power contests that it's like it's a dance, it's a pas de deux. You're dancing, you're tangoing in this mistaken way with your kids that's not leading to the harmony that you want. And in fact, if you want to get out the door on time or get your child to get to bed by the bedtime bell, that you're more likely to reach your goal of being punctual and hitting these deadlines, not by being more forceful and more controlling, but by actually getting more relaxed. That it's your urgency that is creating the resistance and the defiance in the child. It's like, you know, pulling a donkey, right? As soon as you start to pull on that rope, they dig in their heels.
Mm-hmm.
And our gut reaction, if you're a controlling by nature kind of type A person, is to want to pull harder on that donkey rope. And instead, I'm showing them how we can motivate our donkeys to want to come along with us.
Mm,
it's a whole skill set. Yeah.
Yeah, and you gave some nice, for the parents who are listening, some nice clues on whether you're in a power struggle, and then some wonderful how-tos of running a family meeting, which it seems like you feel is very important to shift that dynamic.
It's what helps push the power down in the family and make it more egalitarian and more democratic. And today's kids respond far more. It's a method of having them feel like a social equal so that they're more willing to give you their cooperation, which is very different than asking for compliance or obedience.
Yes. Yes, it is. That was that wonderful chapter. You could probably write a whole book on that one just alone, which maybe we'll end up, in a sense, talking about when we talk about your parenting books.
Right. Yes, I talk much more about that in Honey, I Wrecked the Kids, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then the other myth is good mothers manage sibling conflict. All right, because if we're perfect and controlling, we should have that under control too.
Right, and if we're the adult in the household and our kids are fighting, aren't we supposed to act like the police officer and step in and manage everybody's behavior? Aren't we the disciplinarian in the household? What a common thing to believe. Why would you think any other way? Of course it feels like it's our job description. But when we look at why children fight, I mean, it's an interesting thing. There will always be a little bit of conflict, just like when you get married and you have to decide which way the toilet paper roll goes. You know, I mean, there's going to be some conflict. But when your siblings start to become rivals, when they start to really get into it, when we see why they choose conflict over peace, we have to think that, you know, human beings, even infants in bassinets, they get very uncomfortable if there is somebody beside them crying. We don't like conflict. We're not wired for conflict. It releases all kinds of negative hormones and chemicals, neurotransmitters in our brains, and we're wired to move towards cooperation and peace. So conflict is a distressed state. Why would we go there? Well, we would only go to that distressed state if there was some other benefit. And the benefit tends to be that when mom comes in, or dad comes in, that she gets involved, she gives the attention by saying, stop that, don't do that, don't hit your brother, put that down, who had that first? And kids learn pretty quickly, experientially, that when they play nicely, we get busy on our Blackberries and, you know, start doing laundry and cooking dinner, and when they kerfuffle, we go in and play with them in the sense of correcting them.
Yeah.
It's not really play, but to them it is. It's engagement.
Yeah. Right.
So, you know, why behave well when conflict gets you more mileage?
So true. It's so easy to fall into that, too. And it is true. When my kids were little, if they were playing nicely, I'm like, okay, I'll do the 500 things on my list.
Yeah, because, right, we tiptoe away. Shh, they're playing nicely. Don't ruin it.
Exactly.
So that's my first piece of advice to parents is why not, like, just switch that up right there? When you hear them playing nicely, say, hey, you guys sound like you're having fun. Can I get in on this? And then the first person who, like, flips the board game over or shoves somebody, instead of talking about the action, just say, you know what, it's not fun for me to be around that energy. I'm going to go do something else. That alone for a week will fundamentally bring about a huge change in the way your kids get along.
Oh, that's a nice little nugget.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean that you always have to play with them when they're playing nicely. But if you're in a dynamic that you want to change, you're saying that's a great thing to do.
Exactly. And I give other tips, too, because there's different situations and different ages call for different levels of interventions.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they have different skill set at 8 than they do at 2 and 3, you know?
So two final myths, because we're soon running out of time here, is the only the best education for my child. That's a good one.
Well, I think Canada and the U.S. have a lot of similarities about the cultural urgency to get our kids enriched, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And I understand from family members that live down in the U.S. that the pressure is even greater. Actually, my sister-in-law is a teacher, and she said, like, it's not uncommon for parents to hire academic consultants right from the get-go to map out their child's entire educational arc, you know, basically from birth. And there is a fanaticism about it up in Canada as well. And we're pushing education earlier and earlier and earlier it's really quite problematic that parents want to prepare their kids for kindergarten so that they've completed all of kindergarten before they put their bum on circle time the first day of kindergarten. And now we've got kids that are bored.
Yeah.
And we've got some kids that we know that developmentally different parts of the brain are developing in different children at different times. So where one might be ready for language acquisition, another one is ready for, you know, motor development and running. And you take that a few years later, some kids are ready to read and some kids aren't. But it doesn't mean that they're not going to not be able to read later. And so here we've got a child who's getting this academic pressure and seeing that they're not keeping up with their peers. And it's very easy for them to develop a belief, I'm stupid, or I'm not good at school, or school makes me anxious. And yet we know that if we would have given them a little bit more time and less pressure, that those kids that start later actually catch up. By grade three, most kids are pretty much on the same level. But here now we've got kids who have a bad self-concept about themselves as a learner. And that takes way, way, way longer to undo. And not all kids are going to be academics.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
That's the thing. We're cutting off we're disenfranchising an entire group of society that are going to be, would be much better suited to be in the arts, in philosophy, tile layers, tattoo artists, you know, filmmakers. Those kids, they're not supported. They're not embraced. We're dropping the arts from our schools. Some schools are even dropping science from the curriculum. And so I think we're really misguided with our over-ambitious idea that every kid, this grade inflation and this pressure that if my kid doesn't keep up, they're going to fall behind and they're not going to get a job. It's making us kooky and it's hurting our kids.
That's beautifully said. And maybe we can have you back to talk a little bit more about the difference between discouraged and encouraging a child, because I think that was, you know, a pivotal piece of this chapter and so helpful.
Yeah.
Really wonderful.
So much of not learning really is discouragement rather than academic problems.
Yeah.
You know, and in life and forever.
Yeah, and you give some great examples. Maybe we'll be able to put those in a handout for parents.
That'd
and then
great.
The last myth is good mothers make life fun and entertaining.
Okay, this, I'm so guilty of this, Kim.
I think this one would be true for dads too, don't you?
Yeah, because they get to come home and throw them in the air and pull my finger and ain't it great? And what we found now is that we're almost allergic to boredom. We somehow think that we have to keep our kids happy and entertained all the time. And so, you know, watch the movie in the car and watch your iPad while you're in the stroller waiting to go through customs. And, oh, dad's away and he didn't really get a chance to see you this week. So why don't we, you know, get you a new game to keep you engaged. And we're entertaining our kids to a point where they expect life to always be entertaining. And they expect to always be consuming another toy. You know, well, I'm done with that program, get me another one. And we think it's our job. So we've got kids where mom wants to go off and cook dinner, and the kids are moaning and whining for their parents' attention because they've never learned to be self-entertaining. They've never had to face this thing called boredom. And that's really sad. There's something very important about overcoming boredom that is part of the creativity process that we're denying our kids.
Now that, again, is a whole other topic because of the impact of technology and immediate gratification. And
it's everywhere, right? If you're in the back of the car, you used to have to, like, lollygag and look out the window. And, you know, now, no, you've got a port. You've got your little MP3 player. Entertainment came with you. That's new. That's very new to this generation.
There's so little time to do just to be. And I've fallen into that trap myself. You know, I'll be waiting at a doctor's office and I'll think, oh my gosh, this is such a waste of time.
Right.
I could be doing so many things if only I had brought da 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 da, you know, instead of just being and maybe reading a mindless magazine or taking some intentional deep breaths or I don't know, anything other than doing.
Other than doing, exactly. Mm-hmm. We don't need to, even just, you know, on those old rotary dial phones, if you had to dial zero, you had like click, 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 click. You know, you got a little pause there while you waited to dial the next number. We don't even get that pause in life anymore. We probably will see research on the impact of all this, but what I really wanted parents to understand is like a good slow-aged wine or a cassoulet that takes days to cook, you know, there is benefits to this slow movement that we're seeing now, and there's all kinds of benefits in doing less and being bored and doing things at a different pace with our kids that just might seem less interesting or stimulating on first flush, but that really carry just a tremendous amount of value in terms of bonding the family and helping our kids connect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. So that this will help them have good relationships later in life. Yeah.
Yeah, you can't do speed relationships.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Some things our human nature requires us to do it kind of the way we've always been doing it, you know, over thousands and thousands and thousands of years.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Allison, for coming on. I just want to tell everyone, yes, again, this is Allison Schaefer, author of Breaking the Good Mom Myth, and her website is Allison.ca. Is that correct?
Kim, actually, can I correct? It's actually, I've got a new website, which is AllisonSchaefer.com.
Okay, good. Fabulous. And your books can be found on Amazon, and I believe you said this book is on the Kindle too, right?
This one is, yes.
Fabulous. Thank you again so much for coming on and such a wonderful topic and for writing such a great book.
Thanks for having me, Kim.
You're welcome.